It's episode 309 of Grow Great, the podcast. Website is growgreat.com. My name is Randy Cantrell. I'm coming to you from Dallas, Fort Worth, Texas. I am your host here. Thanks for clicking play. Thanks for listening. You know what to do? Well, you know what you need to do? Then why don't you do it? Today, the content is going to be more of, let's call it documentary. Some content is produced and it's helpful. It's kind of instructional. Other content is also helpful and instructional, but it's done more in a documentary fashion. That is, this is, you know, it's a story of what happened to somebody. This is going to help you, I think, because I'm going to pull the curtain back and I'm going to walk you through why I changed the name of the podcast and the strategy of the podcast not all that long ago, and why now, well, as of late last week, I'm changing it again, back. But first, let me tell you about my experience in completely changing, and I do mean completely changing, my business. Context provides understanding. And so let's kind of start there. My context goes back to my entry into retailing, specifically consumer electronics retail. I walked into a local hi-fi store when I was a high school kid, and I asked for a sales job. I had zero sales experience. But I loved stereo equipment, and I loved music, and I loved records. And so with no experience but a lot of enthusiasm, I got a job selling stereo equipment for straight commission. That meant I got no pay unless I sold something, which is illegal today, but this is back in the mid-70s. I loved retailing. I loved stereo gear. I loved music. I loved observing human behavior. I loved performance-based pay. Okay, not necessarily all of those in that order, but I found it quite thrilling, this whole pay based on merit, which is what straight commission is all about. By the time I was 25 years old, I was leading a multi-million dollar company. And by then, well, you know, I had a lot of experience. And by the time I was 50, well, I had almost 35 years of experience in selling, merchandising, advertising, managing, leading, operating. And it was time to pass on what experience had taught me and to lean more into my passions of being a good operator and a good leader. Now, as a lifelong learner and reader, I had been consumed with leadership, management, human behavior, psychology, consumer behavior, marketing, and sales for, I don't know, for as long as I could remember. I was still in high school when I first read of W. Edwards Deming. He was the man that General Douglas MacArthur brought to Japan in 1951 after World War II to help with the census after that war. Deming was a brilliant engineer, and he is largely responsible for helping Japan come back to power and basically become a world dominant power in manufacturing. This was long before Korea, long before China came into the picture. If you can't describe what you are doing as a process, you don't know what you're doing. It is not necessary to change. Survival is not mandatory. It is not enough to do your best. You must know what to do and then do your best. Those are all statements attributed to Mr. Deming. I mean, I told you the guy was brilliant. Well, I was obsessed with improvement. I was obsessed with my own improvement. I was obsessed with the improvement of the companies that I was running. Books have always surrounded me. Business books, self-help, well, they're now called personal development books, psychology or human behavior books, marketing books, sales books, biography, leadership books. I have invested gobs and gobs of money in books, but I have invested even more time in reading those books. Fact is, I have invested far more than Malcolm Gladwell's proverbial 10,000 hours to watching human behavior, especially consumer behavior. In fact, I would venture to guess that I have invested 7 to 8 times that many hours in practicing the craft. Trying things, experimenting, watching how people respond, seeing how people behave, working hard to figure things out, connect the dots. Now, I didn't always succeed. I have failed plenty. and the failures were all mine. The successes were mostly the result of having good, sometimes great people around me. But I figured a few things out along the way. Mostly, I figured myself out. I'm still working on it, mind you, but I've come a long way. By the time I left the C-suite, I was ready to do more significant work, work that would be legacy work. I found myself using the phrase passing it on. I found myself saying that just way too much. And I was slowly but surely leaning more and more and more into who I really am. And who I really am is a communicator who thrives in helping people figure things out. I'd long known that I was different in a lot of respects. Growing up, I was envious of people who were not plagued with what I saw as a big burden. I was a noticer. Small details were inescapable. Subtle human behaviors just stood out like a sore thumb for me. Things that other people didn't seem to notice, they would just leap out at me, refusing to be ignored. I could sense things with alarming accuracy, simply by watching people's facial expressions, body language, vocal tone. I mean, it was all just ridiculously annoying to me growing up, and quite frankly, for a large part of my adulthood. Empathy was a natural gift. Words were too. Compassion, that was easy. That was necessary. That just simply meant that my empathy drove compassion, which is the fuel for doing something to help, to serve. Absolutely, along the way, I suffered being taken advantage of. No question. I suffered being disappointed in people. I suffered disappointment in the foolish choices that people would make, often destructive choices. And at every turn, I was naturally wired to figure out why they did what they did. I was completely obsessed with understanding. According to the Myers-Briggs survey, I am an INFJ. That just basically means that I'm introverted, I'm highly intuitive, I'm emotionally driven, and discerning or judging. Now, I appear like an extrovert much of the time, but the fact is I am fueled by going deep with people, as deeply as people are willing to go. INFJ personality types are often called counselors because there is something that we emit. There is some signal. I don't know what it is, but there's something that other people clearly pick up on that lets them know how anxious we are to help. And so people tend to easily lean on us for assistance. And I'm just speaking for myself. I love it. I absolutely love it. I love being that guy. Mostly, I love that people feel safe with me and that people trust me, because keeping secrets is not hard for me. Being discreet is not hard for me. Forgiveness, super easy. Bitterness is hard. Now, before you start thinking that I'm all that and then some, I have some very serious flaws. For starters, I think I can help anybody in any situation. And that's completely ridiculous. And I also know that logically it's not true. And yet I still believe it. And I'm going to die trying. I'm also an over-communicator, which can drive my family nuts, because I enjoy understanding, which means I ask questions, a lot of questions, and I enjoy conveying what I'm feeling. Now, I only enjoy that to those with whom I feel the safest. And that usually means, at least for me, that it's an extremely small number of people who really get to that level with me. And it's not because I'm unwilling. It's not because I'm guarded. It's simply as I don't even think it's, I started to say, you know, maybe it's because I'm not willing to be vulnerable, but I don't sense that either. I really think I'm completely willing to be vulnerable. I just think it's mostly because I'm unwilling to impose, because that's how it feels to me. It's been said for a long, long time of INFJ personality types that we counsel others, but we find it hard to accept help ourselves. And that is truer than you may know. Accepting help is very difficult because it's a role reversal that I'm just not used to. When I left leading multimillion-dollar companies, I set about to help business owners and leaders tackle their problems. These were people that I could relate to. They were my peers. These were people who I understood. I got it. I was a lifelong operator, an expert in human behavior. a guy with mad dog people skills and those soft skills, if you please, but I had no experience in professional services like executive or CEO coaching. For the past 10 years or so, I have experienced success and failure along the way, diving deeply into the problems of CEOs and top-level leaders and their teams. And what began as really a roll-up-your-sleeves, get-your-hands-dirty consulting morphed into just coaching. I hated consulting. I loved coaching. Well, truth be told, there are elements of coaching I really loved. Now, let me make a distinction for you so that you really understand. Consulting is I'll do it for you. I hated that. Not that I hated doing it, but I couldn't really own it because right at the end of the day, somebody could completely undo whatever you did because, well, you're just a consultant. Coaching, on the other hand, is here, well, let's help you figure out how you can do it yourself. Way more profitable, number one, way more fun. True confession, there was something that I absolutely hated with a passion, getting clients. And it's not for the reasons you may think. It's not because I hated selling or because I wasn't very good at selling. Quite the contrary. It was because I was selling me. It was just way too personal, and it just felt way too nasty. Too much self-promotion, something that is insanely difficult for me, something that I have great respect and admiration for in others, but it's just, I might as well push water up a hill. In a world filled with thought leaders, I found myself saying to people quite seriously, I might add, I'm struggling to lead my own thoughts, so I'm in no position at all to lead yours. So don't call me a thought leader. I would never in a million years say I'm a thought leader. Yeah, it was kind of slightly tongue-in-cheek, but frankly, it was more real than probably people even understand when I would say that. But I meant it. In fact, I still mean it. Now, along the way, I rubbed shoulders with authors and speakers and experts and self-proclaimed thought leaders. And sometimes I would envy these people. Mostly, I didn't feel at home around these people. These were not my people. I was trying to learn from these people, though. I was trying very hard to figure out what the most successful among them had figured out. And make no mistake, many of them have figured a bunch of things out. Namely, how to grow and build a successful enterprise so that more people could be served. And at every turn, it was growing increasingly more obvious that it wasn't my natural wiring to promote the way I needed to exude the confidence and the bravado that the world seems to pay attention to, that the world absolutely positively responds to. There's just no mistaking it. At the same time, I was finding success just being true to who I was. I mean, I've landed as many clients as not by sitting down with people in that very first meeting, listening to what they most want to accomplish, and figuring out sometimes, quite frequently, that I'm likely not the best option for these people and their particular situation. And I just flatly tell them so. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've sat in front of people and or been on the phone and said, I'm probably not the best option to address the specifics of what you seem to want. And I may even say, I'm not using this as a ploy to get you to want to hire me. I genuinely think you may find somebody with experience in your space who can better serve you. And I meant it. And they'll often look at me, and I know the look. It's the look, I want to hire you. And it makes me feel good, but it puts tremendous pressure on me to over-deliver. Now, that's something I'm naturally wired to do anyway, and I'm going to do. That second mile and all that, that's just part of my wiring. I take every engagement very personally and give it my all. In fact, I could argue, and those really close to me, especially my wife, would tell you, I can get way, way too vested in the people. I don't know that that's possible. Other people look at it and claim it is, and maybe they're right. Maybe I'm wrong. It's just the only way I know to operate. I get fully invested in these people that I serve, which for me is great until the engagement ends. And then I'm kind of wrecked for a period of time because it feels like the loss of a close relationship. I mean, people who have shared their deepest, darkest fears and their challenges and their opportunities, people who found me safe, people who trusted me completely, and then we say goodbye after, I don't know, 6 months, after 3 years. I maintain contact with at least and this is a low number, it's probably closer to 90%, but with at least 80% of everybody that I've ever served. Now, it may be just a random text message where I say, just checking in on you. Hope all's well. Or it may be a lunch where we break bread together and we catch up. I just don't know any other way to be. About 4 years ago, I was given an epiphany. Well, okay. I'm being too big and too bold, probably calling it an epiphany. It was more like a moment of enlightenment. I became aware of something I did not know about, not fully. Peer advisory groups, professional peer advisory groups. And it instantly made sense to me. Join yourself to other people who share one big thing in common. In this case, everybody would be an entrepreneur or a CEO. No matter that everybody is running a company that may be in a very different space from everybody else, the common denominator is running a business. That provided instant understanding. Everybody knows what it is to meet payroll, to generate revenues, to handle HR issues, to serve customers, all those other things that are involved in operating a profitable business. The power's in the difference, though. The various experiences and the insights and places from which these people are coming gives everybody an opportunity to bring to the table something that's unique, uniquely theirs, and that is the perspective that they bring. And that perspective is different. And because that perspective is different, there's great value in that. Well, one evening on this journey, it had me thinking about typical, if there is such a thing, typical support groups. And that led me to one particular group that I found quite by accident. The National Organization of Parents of Murdered Children, Inc. You heard me right. The National Organization of Parents of Murdered Children, Inc. Now, I've seen enough shows on the ID channel to have some understanding of the searing pain that parents suffer at getting that kind of dreadful news. But I can't possibly understand it, not really, because it has not happened to me. And I instantly thought, what better place could there be for any parent in that situation? I mean, you walk into the room, you introduce yourself or somebody introduces you, and that's it. I mean, that you're in. Everybody in the room is just like you. They know that they understand your pain. They've been where you are. And you realize that these people, they have been where you are. I mean, it's just this instant bond and trust. But the power is in the differences. Because some of these people in this room, they're further up the trail. They've dealt with their pain a lot longer than you have. They understand these different stages that you've yet to go through. And some of these people are wired very differently than you because everybody's coming from their own unique experience and their own place in life and their own personality and their own ways of dealing with it. And yet they all know the pain of losing a child to murder. A single tie that binds the huge elephant in the room. But the differences are where the power is to get through it. And it just made sense to me. In fact, the truth is, it makes sense to anybody who will listen to that analogy. It universally makes sense, right? And that led to leveraging some information that was made more clearly known to me by a book, The Knowing-Doing Gap by Jeffrey Pfeiffer and Robert Sutton. It was published in 2000. And the book, and I read it when it first came out, and I've been a fan of it ever since, so for nearly 20 years. The book focuses on companies closing that gap between what they know and what they do. And the argument put forth, and it's quite valid, I think, is that quite often we know enough, we just don't do enough. If we would just do what we know instead of constantly seeking to know more, well, what if we just did what we know to do? Yeah, keep adding to your knowledge, but you got to put knowledge to work. It's equally true of us as individuals. In fact, it's one big, big reason why Leo Battari began this enterprise, this new initiative, Peernovation, to make that learning come to life. You've read books, you've gone to seminars, you've gone to workshops, you've gone to conferences, and you've learned a ton of great stuff. And then next Thursday happens. You don't use any of it. Oh, it was all great. It was kind of inspiring even, but you don't do anything with it. Countless gazillions of dollars are spent every year in training and teaching and instruction. Toward what end? Well, largely it's just wasted It's just wasted money. You likely already know enough. You're not likely doing everything you already know you should do. Well, I dove more deeply into this whole peer advisory advantage, people surrounding themselves with others who are like them in some way. Now, for me, it was either everybody was a CEO or a business owner. And I knew it was work that I was just meant to do. How to make the transition was not something that I really fully understood yet. I'm really, really fond of a phrase. I would give attribution, but I don't know who said it or who wrote it. But everything is hard until it's easy. Everything is hard until it's easy. And it is just, it's just absolutely true. We each hold personal truths. Now, these personal truths that we hold, these are not empirical truths. In other words, these are the truths that form our reality. And they may not be real. They may, but they may not be. We just think they are. And we behave as though they are. These personal truths, they drive our behavior. Empirical truths don't necessarily drive our behavior. Mostly, we chase more information. Now, me personally, I'm not prone to data overload. I don't go seeking more information before I reach a conclusion, and yet I lean heavily toward evidence. Because my tuition is so high, I just want to do my very best to make sure that I'm seeing it as it really is. One of my biggest fears is I don't want to connect dots that aren't connected. I don't want to make sense of something that doesn't make sense. Now, if the decision is important, which just simply means that the stakes are higher, then I will look for more evidence that I am seeing things correctly. If the stakes are low, which just means the stakes aren't very high at all, then I'm comfortable. I'm pretty confident in just leaning more on my intuition. Well, I'd been coaching individual people. I'd been coaching small groups. And the work had been very personal, very intimate. It was always in the context of other challenges and opportunities and experiences. And in every case, there was also one other big, big element. And I had not really thought of this until quite recently. And that other big important element was internal politics, because I realized that in most all engagements, the politics were so enormous that they impacted every decision that was made by the individuals or by the teams. In every engagement, the coaching sessions had to take into account politics. I mean, it's just how it went. Now, I had not analyzed this before. I just accepted it because it was the reality. Working to get myself up to speed on peer advisory groups was opening my eyes to some existing things that just weren't working for me personally. I was growing increasingly unhappy over the last number of years because, well, I was having to regulate myself more and more and more, and I didn't like it. I didn't like it. Now, I'm not talking about self-control. I'm not talking about temperance. I'm talking about just innately having to be someone that you're not. And I didn't know until quite recently that, yeah, there's the thing that's killing me. It's these politics. It's these, in my opinion, many times these broken cultures. I mean, for example, candid conversations are very easy for me. I relish them because I put a high premium on candor and honesty. And quite frankly, they just work. I know they work. I know from years and years and years of experience, they work. Beating around the proverbial bush, talking in riddles, making clear things mysterious is a surefire recipe for poor performance, for unhappy and disengaged people. But I had often found myself surrounded by that kind of behavior, the kind of behavior that leaders would beat around the bush. They would talk in riddles. They would make clear things mysterious. And in some cases, the leaders were quite committed to that effort. They wanted me to change their people, when in reality, they were the problem. And somewhere along the way, I kind of got lost. I just don't mind telling you, somewhere I did. I never wanted to sell out, because every engagement took a large part of who I am and just seemed to erode who I was, some much more than others. Sitting down with people, helping them, would always give me energy, always. Dealing with the politics, knowing that they were in a circumstance where so many other things beyond performance had to be considered, and I knew that, just sucked the life right out of me. by the time I reached out to Leo Battari a number of years ago, Leo had co-authored a book, Power of Peers, How the Company You Keep Drives Leadership Growth and Success. And by the time I had reached out to Leo, I knew I was due for a major change. I just didn't yet know how. I didn't know what that meant. And Leo and I became fast friends, and I began to learn. And I began to learn some more, and I began to learn some more. And along the way, I decided it was time to push all my chips into the middle of the table, bet the farm on becoming a leader of peer groups. A leader of peer groups. And that is what prompted or gave birth to the idea of thepeeradvantage.com. Twice. That's right, twice. I have made a shift in this podcast by renaming this podcast the Peer Advantage Podcast. Thought was, you know, become the podcast with that focus. And the first time I didn't do it, well, the first time I did do it with just not a whole lot of thought. The second time, the most recent time I did it, just a month or so ago, I did it with a lot of forethought. It was a mistake. It was a mistake and a failure both times. I was not doing what I knew to do. I was not doing what I knew. I was not doing what I'm preaching for you to do. I was not doing what I knew to do. Instead, I began to do what I knew I likely shouldn't do. Yeah, but I was desperate to make this shift. I was desperate to make this change in my life's work. What do you want to be known for? I had asked myself. And I wasn't asking that in some vanity sense. I was asking that in a marketing or a business sense. And my answer was, I want to run at least two online peer groups serving business leaders. That's what I want to do. Well, that answer was, as you can tell, that answer was not focused at all on identity as much as it was focused on what I wanted to do. Truth was, I simply did not want to be restricted to worrying about helping somebody navigate the politics inside their organization. Instead, I wanted to help top-level leaders, the ones mostly responsible for those politics and for that culture. I wanted to work with those people to forge ahead in building, growing, sustaining high-performing organizations. The only way to do that is to help the person at the top. Well, that insight's important because, well, it made the change of this podcast to the Peer Advantage even more idiotic. Bad move, failure. And it's why I'm pulling the curtain back today and just sharing, you know, showing you my underwear here so that you can learn something from this. Well, why? Why was that a bad move? Why was it a failure? Well, quite simply because more than 99% of top-level leaders have any experience with professional peer advisory groups. Almost nobody has experienced this. Almost nobody understands the true value of being surrounded by other CEOs or other entrepreneurs. And many others who still don't understand them think that they're something they're not. I mean, I can't tell you how many people I've encountered who think that, you know, I'm starting a networking group where entrepreneurs are going to exchange business, you know, some sort of you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours kind of a deal. No, it's not what it is. Some others think it's just, you know, it's just a good old boys club where we're going to get together and we're going to shoot the breeze and everybody catch it. No, it's not that. Almost nobody I've encountered in the last few years to engage in conversations about the power of peers understand it in a professional context. Almost nobody. I mean, statistically, fewer than 1% of CEOs ever experience it, and yet there is empirical, and yes, I said it, empirical evidence that it has a colossally profitable effect. I'm empathetic about all this, but it was puzzling because almost everybody gets the power of peers when it comes to kids. I haven't had a parent yet. I haven't had a grandparent yet who doesn't get it when it comes to applying it to their kids. We all seem to fully understand the impact that our friends had on us when we were young. And those of us who are parents or grandparents, we understand absolutely how important it is that our kids run with the right group. Trust me, you've got little kids. You care about who their friends are. I know you do. We care about who our friends run with. We don't seem to understand how that exact same power is present in our lives as adults. And that's important because it's what drove me to make the change in this podcast, a change that I repeat was a failure and it was the wrong move. I knew what to do. But instead of doing it, I did something different. I didn't think clearly, and I got impatient, and that's a big, big player here. I got really impatient. That's a big part of my failure. In fact, truth be told, that's a big part of every failure. I reached out to a couple of podcasting buddies. I sent an email out, and these are guys who have vast knowledge of the medium of podcasting and how it all works. And not just from a technical viewpoint, but from a marketing viewpoint, from a building an audience standpoint. One of them responded right away. The other one didn't respond at all. And I didn't think a lot about it. But what I did do is, rather than move forward with my plan to have these guys question me and challenge me and help me figure this out, when I didn't get the response from one of the two, I just dove in. I already told you, INFJ, it's a big problem. We're considered kind of counselors, but what's our weakness? Accepting help. I just dove in and did what I felt I ought to do in the moment. I made the change, and almost immediately I felt like it just didn't feel right. It didn't matter. I leaned into it anyway, because I'm not afraid to try something, and I'm really not afraid to fail, and I'm really not afraid to fail in front of you. I just wanted to get it right. Okay, but I didn't get it right. I got it wrong, way wrong. Well, some weeks go by, and now I hear from the buddy who had not responded. Now he tells me, you know, sorry, I just now getting around to this, just now saw this, and hey, I'm in. Well, of course, by now I've already pulled the trigger and shot my foot off. He was up for the challenge, but, you know, I'm multiple episodes into this change now, too late. I had not given enough breath to the process. Maybe that's happened to you. Maybe it is happening to you. Just tap the brakes and stop and pause and think. Instead, what I had done, I had dug in and I'd made a move that likely could have been prevented, a failure that I could have avoided if I would have just relied on these two trusted friends, friends who understand me, who understand podcasting, who understand my context. No, I didn't do that. I ignored it. Trudged forward, even though at some level I knew what to do and I knew that they could have helped me. You know the story. The emperor has no clothes, stark naked, but he doesn't know he's naked. Yeah, that was me. Here I was embarking on making major shifts in my business and this podcast, aiming to help people learn how to leverage the power of others, and I was forced to face the reality was I'm not even drinking my own Kool-Aid. I mean, I'm not doing the very thing that I'm preaching. I was completely hypocritical. I was trying to go it alone when I had two buddies who I had solicited, and they were now perfectly willing to help me. The lesson isn't any different for you. We are driven to do things. We are driven because of the nature of who we are as leaders. We are driven to make things happen. Patience is not likely one of our strong suits. We are driven to get things done. We are driven to accomplish things. And that sometimes means that we're driven to shoot from the hip. I could have avoided the confusion, the failure, and feeling crappy about myself if I had leveraged the power of others. These guys were willing to serve me simply because I had asked. That's the kind of guys these are. It's the kind of relationship we have. In fact, I'll go you one better. I told them both that I'd like to record it because I felt like the conversation might benefit other podcasters who were fretting about changing their business or their podcast. And I still think that was a good idea, a really good idea. And I had some really brilliant questions that I put to them in this email that I wanted them to basically make me wrestle and answer. But I blew it. I ripped it to shreds with absolutely almost no thought, because I got antsy. And after some weeks of thinking I shouldn't have done this, I just stopped. I mean, one day last week, I just got up and decided I'm going back to Grow Great, and I'm not even going to say anything. I'm just going to do it. I did say something, a little something, but not much. Classic case of neglecting to do what I knew I should, and even more classic case of making a decision without the insights of others fully capable and fully willing to help me. Guilty of preaching one message and doing something completely contrary to it. Yeah, just insert Homer Simpson right here saying, "Doh." I mean, it was a doh moment. Now, there are likely so many things in your life as a leader, as a business owner, that you already know how to do, but you are not doing them. I want to encourage you to get in touch with those things. Let me encourage you and push you to sit down and think more soberly about what those things are. And here, let me give you a few tips that might help. You and I both know there's no hard, fast answers here. You've just got to do the work to figure this out. Number one, write down the top three things that are putting pressure on you today, right now, and put them in order of importance. No more than three, but you can do three. You got to at least do one, but don't do more than three. Put them in order. Okay, now number two, focus on the top one. Wrestle it down. Make sure, is that really the number one problem? If it is the number one problem, is there anything that you feel very confident about doing with regard to that one issue, but you have not yet done it? You're not doing it. Anything at all come to mind? It doesn't matter if it's big or small. Just one thing that you are thinking you should do, that you know you should do, but for whatever reason you have not yet done it. Listen, it could be something as innocuous as calling a meeting to discuss this problem with all the different people that might be involved or people that might be influenced by a better decision. It could be something that more concrete. It could be an important decision that absolutely requires that you take some concrete action. Just narrow your attention on this one thing that you could do next. Number three, do that one thing. Go ahead, call that meeting, make the decision, do whatever it is that might move you forward. The one thing with this one thing that you believe, this is what I know to do, but I've not done it. Today's the day I do it. Number four, measure the impact. How did it work out? Does it feel right? Is it working out favorably? I mean, get a grip on whether it's working, whether it's not working. Does it need more time? Give it more time. Number five, get feedback from people who can help. This is really important, and it's something I neglected to do. I skipped this step. Well, truth is, I skipped a lot of these steps. And as a result, I created chaos and confusion, not only for you as a listener, but for me as a producer. And it could have all been avoided. But I got impatient, and I got stupid. Huddle with people who can provide valuable insight so that you can better understand the adjustments you should make. And we've all got to make adjustments. You and I both know the odds of you pulling the trigger on that very first shot and hitting the bullseye, slim and none. It could happen, but it's not likely. The second shot, the third shot, those are the important shots. But they're only important if you're paying attention to the target. Where did I hit it last? How do I need to adjust my aim? Number six, take action based on whatever commitment you made to yourself based on the feedback. So you make the decision, you do the action, you take whatever step this is, this one thing that you know you should do, but you've not yet done it, and you do it. And now you get feedback from people. You've measured the impact, and now you're getting feedback. Okay, now what should I do? Now what should be next? And you take action based on that commitment, the commitment you made to yourself. Number seven, lean on the people who provided the feedback to help you become or remain accountable for what you decided. You owe this to yourself. Now, this is less about what you owe the other people, the people who helped you. It really is all about what you owe to yourself, what you owe to your own forward progress, what you owe to your own success. And number eight, well, keep doing this. Just keep doing this so that you can develop better habits, focusing on the important things, these critical decisions that you need to make. And you can develop a habit of leaning on other people to help you do it better. If you exercise these steps on the very first thing, remember, you wrote down three problems, three things that were putting pressure on you. Now go do it with number two and do it with number three on your list. Don't neglect those things. But it doesn't mean you have to commingle these things with that very number one thing. It doesn't mean that you can't tackle three things at once. You do that all the time, and sometimes that's necessary. But you need to do each item the way you need to do it. They may or may not influence each other. That's for you to decide. But tackle every problem this way. You will figure this out. Others can help you accelerate that. And they can make it way more effective, way more impactful. Stop behaving like a hermit with all the answers. Save yourself the time, the embarrassment, and the failure that often accompany stubbornness. That's right. I mean, it's what I was. I've made a commitment to myself. I'm going to lean on people that I trust, period. I mean, come on. I can't embark on this venture and not do what I'm preaching and advocating that you should do. I mean, it's it's the very heart throb of the work that I'm proposing to do, that I want to do, work that I think provides some of the highest value on the planet, because it's the power of others. And we are, after all, in this together. Oh, I know you feel alone, and I know you feel like nobody understands and nobody knows, but you're wrong. You're wrong. And I know you're thinking that because I've thought it too. And I was wrong. Big time wrong. Be well, do good, grow great. My name is Randy Cantrell. The website is growgreat.com. Lord willing, I'll see you. Well, I'm going to try to see you on Thursday. We'll see how it goes. But you will see me, Lord willing, before the end of the week. Thanks.